Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while we print layer upon layer of weird and wonderful science directly onto your imagination. I'm Ian Wolfe. On this edition, Martin Wegener talks about 3D printing on the nanoscale. But first up, news of smart hands and incriminating handshakes. A hand with feeling. Swedish researchers from Chalmers University of Technology and the Integrum AB company working in the European Commission Horizon 2020 project DTOP have developed a new kind of prosthetic hand that's wired directly into the below elbow stump of a person's arm to allow fine control from nerves to the prosthetic hand and a sense of touch from the hand to the nerves in the person's stump. Attaching prosthetic hands to people with below-the-elbow amputations has been difficult because there are two small bones in the arm below the elbow, rather than the one large bone above the elbow, to attach to. The advantage is that there are more motor nerves below the elbow for the prosthetic to connect to, allowing much finer motor control. The project has taken 10 years to reach this point. A team from the University of Gothenburg worked on understanding the way in which humans perceive touch and how machines can replicate this, while a team from Lund University worked on the way in which humans produce motor control and the algorithms that can replicate it. Titanium implants were placed in two forearm bones, the radius and ulna, from which 16 electrodes to nerves and muscles were extended to extract signals for fine control of the robotic hand and to provide feelings of touch. Previous prosthetic hands were only able to be opened and closed and have no sense of touch. The new hand can tell its owner whether it's touching something and how strongly it's grasping. The hand can move the thumb and forefinger separately or together, and the other three fingers as one unit, separately or together with the forefinger and thumb. The first person to have the hand attached to her stump has had to have rehabilitation exercises to strengthen the bone of her hand to be able to hold the weight of the implant, while she practiced controlling a virtual version of the prosthetic hand on a computer screen. At the same time, the software behind the virtual hand was learning how to respond more efficiently to her mental commands, transferred by the electrodes implanted in her lower arm muscles. The software she trains will be part of the real prosthetic hand she wears. Two more patients will be implanted with this new generation of prosthetic hands in the upcoming months, in Italy where the hands were made, and in Sweden. Incriminating handshakes. At a presentation at the annual meeting of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, Cynthia Kale of the Houston Forensic Science Center reported her findings that a 10-second handshake could transfer a person's DNA to an object that the person never touched. The DNA was transferred to a knife when the person's handshaking partner grasped the handle. In a separate study by Leanne Reiser, a forensic anthropologist from the University of Indianapolis, the last person to touch an object, such as a communal jug or pitcher, was often not the one who left the most DNA behind. The findings suggest that even brief contact with another person or object could spread DNA far and wide, which investigators and defense lawyers need to take into account. In her original experiments, Dr. Kale had examined 2-minute handshakes, but had shortened them to 10 seconds on receiving criticism that 2 minutes wasn't realistic. Her work showed that even after the 10-second handshake, someone's DNA could be transferred to the handle of a knife that they'd never touched. The person who never touched the knife was the strongest source of DNA 7% of the time. In Dr. Reiser's experiment, four University of Indianapolis students sat around a table and poured drinks from a communal jug. In Dr. Reiser's experiment, four University of Indianapolis students sat around a table and poured drinks from a communal jug. Other students watching the experiment were free to leave the room, talk, and move around to simulate conditions in a restaurant. As each student at the table handled the jug and a plastic cup, researchers swabbed the jug handle, cups, and the students' hands for DNA. DNA from students at the table was found on the jug handle and on each other's cups, even though the volunteers handled only their own cup and the jug. What's more, DNA from other students in the room showed up as well, but none of the observers had touched the students at the table or the jug or the cups. Observers' DNA may have spread to the cups and jug through tiny droplets as the onlookers talked, coughed, or sneezed. Looking at the amounts of DNA left behind on the objects, the researchers couldn't determine who handled the jug last, neither could they pinpoint how long a person had touched the jug or cup. The results demonstrate that DNA can transfer easily in social settings and in unpredictable ways. Forensic scientists are still trying to work out how this changes the way they should analyse DNA evidence. In an article in the journal Nature, Cynthia Kale said, such transfer could also dilute the statistics generated from DNA evidence and thereby render strong genetic evidence almost insignificant. She goes on to be concerned about the term touch DNA. This conveys to a courtroom that biological material found on an object is the result of direct contact, when in fact, forensic scientists have no way of knowing whether the DNA was left behind by primary direct transfer. It could also have been deposited by secondary transfer through an intermediary. It could be a shaken hand, or you could touch something else. Dr. Kale gives the example of a man accused of murder based on DNA evidence. In California in 2013, a man called Lucas Anderson was arrested, held for 4 months, and charged with murder after his DNA was found under the fingernails of a homicide victim. Anderson had never met the victim and was severely intoxicated and in hospital when the man was killed. The same paramedics who took Anderson to hospital responded to the murder. Most likely, the paramedics were covered in Anderson's DNA, which they then inadvertently transferred to the murder scene. The charges against him were dropped. Cynthia Kale's talk was titled Indirect DNA Transfer, the Impact of Contact Length on Skin-to-Skin to Object DNA Transfer, and Leanne Reiser's talk was titled The Strengths and Limitations of Transfer DNA Evidence Recovered from Objects Handled by Multiple Individuals, both presented at the annual meeting of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. You're listening to Ian Wolfe on Diffusion Science Radio. Send emails to science@diffusionradio.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network and podcast over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com. Nano 3D printing. Professor Martin Wegener is from the Karlsruhe Institute of Technology and its Cluster of Excellence in 3D Additive Manufacturing driven towards the molecular scale. He was visiting Sydney University for the week and gave a talk on nano 3D printing as part of the Sydney Big Ideas Festival. I met with him at Sydney University and began by asking him, what is nano 3D printing?
It's the nano version of 3D printing. I mean, the general picture is that you somehow localize in three-dimensional space how you deposit a material. You put a little Lego block, or we usually refer to it as the voxel in analogy to the pixel, the picture element. And then we put these voxels together to build up three-dimensional matter. It can be devices, can be entire systems. So in nano 3D printing, these voxels are pretty small. They have extents down to 100 nanometers or so, laterally speaking. And then you can do all kinds of things, including structures for optical purposes, for example.
And what material are you using for printing?
So we very often use materials that are based on polymers. So very loosely speaking, this is like plexiglass or so, PMMA. But this can be doped with other materials. It can also be ceramic type of materials. We're going in the direction of making this yet broader, such that you can involve semiconducting materials or metallic materials, but we're not quite there yet.
And you're using a system with lasers and the liquid polymer.
Yeah, very often. The liquid is not necessary. The laser is the tool number one for us. We use a laser focus to make this localization in three-dimensional space I was talking about. And if you use very high-end microscope lenses, you can bring this down to below the wavelength. What the laser does is, in some sense, it induces a chemical reaction. It can be, as you mentioned, that it brings you from a liquid monomer to a solid material. But there are other examples where we start from solid materials and you just modify the solid. But at the end of the day, you must induce some contrast, some gradient, such that you can wash out one of the materials, either the one that has seen the light or the one that has not seen the light. Usually, it's the one that has not seen the light that we wash out at the end of the day.
And you talked about going smaller than the wavelength, so there's some tricks you can use to make it smaller than people used to think was possible.
Yeah, and smaller than I used to think was possible. We can routinely go down to, say, 1/10 of a wavelength in terms of this voxel size, and that takes advantage of chemical nonlinearities, kind of a threshold behavior of the photoresist. And in principle, there is not even any limit on the line width. There is a limit as it comes to how close two voxels can be adjacent to one another, but even that can be overcome if you play tricks like Stefan Hell got the Nobel Prize for in microscopy, where you use a second laser then that kind of erases the outskirts of the first laser focus. And then in principle, at least from an optics point of view, there is no limitation at all how fine you can go. But then, of course, other limits kick in. The chemistry that you use can be a limit. Actually, it's not entirely clear to me what the limits are. That's something we are trying to find out. And once we have found out, to overcome and do better.
So with these tiny, tiny things that you can make, what are some of the uses that you're putting it towards?
There are various ones. I mean, one that we started with is optics. And there you need these fine features because the wavelength of light in the visible is roughly half a micron or so. And you have to be finer than that. Otherwise, light is just being scattered and surfaces don't look smooth, optically speaking. And what you can do is you can realize all kinds of micro-optical components, like lenses or free-form surfaces, as we call them, anything that controls the light on a small scale. And some of these can be mass-replicated, others cannot. That depends on the topology. Other possibilities are that you use this for the making of scaffolds for cell culture. That's something I talked about on Tuesday here also. And the idea is that you use these scaffolds to guide cell growth in three dimensions. Three dimensions are important because all of us are three-dimensional. You don't really want to do this on surfaces only. But there the challenges are much larger, I would say, than in optics because you have to do something with these surfaces of these materials. You have to functionalize them. You have to put proteins, something that cells like, basically. And you have to do this in different ways, in different spots, if you really want to guide cells in three dimensions. And that's something that we are doing big time together with scientists, biologists from Heidelberg and Karlsruhe in our cluster of excellence at KIT.
And if we go back briefly to, there was a masking and there's stamping as well, so that there's ways of making an original on the 3D printer and then making copies industrially?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the topology. If you take a topology like a sponge, for example, like a Swiss cheese that has lots of holes inside, that you have to make one by one. You cannot replicate it easily. But if you have, say, a spherical surface, a part of a sphere, that you can then make once as a master, and then you reproduce it by stamping techniques. I'm saying stamping, these have more fancy words like soft imprinting or hot embossing. There are all kinds of techniques around there that allow you to replicate such surfaces once you have one original. But that may be difficult to get that original.
And going back to the cell scaffolds, so you can actually build structures with different types of cells by attracting them to different parts of the scaffold?
we're not making the cells, we're just making the scaffolds. And then by using multiple steps of 3D printing, we can take different materials, and these materials can attach to them different proteins. We have now even learned how to get rid of certain parts in the structure again, kind of a subtractive manufacturing, to use a fancy word. And with that, you can almost get anything that you need for biological purposes. But now the stage is that we really have to apply it to biology, and this takes also biological expertise.
And can you use this to grow little models of organs?
Yeah, that's our goal. I mean, it's kind of boring to just watch cells grow. What we want to do is really reconstruct functioning organs. Biologists call this organotypic systems. It's kind of happening in a designer petri dish environment. And we concentrate in Karlsruhe and Heidelberg on a particular class of systems, and these are retinas. We want to get a functioning retina, a vertebrate retina, but this could also be a human retina. And the idea would be that in some years, I mean, it's not there yet, but in some years you could use this first to test medication on these artificial retinas. But perhaps if things work out very nicely and another 10 years go by, this could be eventually implanted as a new retina into people that are blind.
It would be amazing. So you could actually design and grow a human retina in maybe 20 years.
Maybe, yeah. We don't know. I'm optimistic. These things have evolved very quickly. But then as it comes to medical applications, you have to be careful.
And you can also deal with multiple materials in the 3D printer.
Yeah, that's something that has been developed only fairly recently. For many years, we and others were only able to print one material, this plastic stuff, these polymers. But this has become much richer now. There's no limit anymore. We can put them sequentially, as many as you want, basically. We have used 7 different ones, but that's not a limitation. If you need that, you can scale it up to 50. If you need to, we have come up with tricks that you don't even have to use different photoresists as an input, but rather take one very fancy photoresist, and then during the printing you change some conditions, you change the laser power, could be the laser polarization, could be the color of the light, you could apply some electric field in principle, whatever, change some parameter during the printing, and as a result of that you get very different materials out. And a few years ago, the differences were very, very small, but there have been recent examples where the differences, say, in the stiffness of a material, in the Young's modulus or in the thermal expansion coefficient, can be larger than a factor of 10. And then you can really do also active structures that move, for example. You could envision having this in such a scaffold, and while a cell is growing, you tickle it from one side or you stretch it just to influence its behavior in a way that you want.
Is that what they're calling 4D printing?
Yeah, some people call this 4D printing. I usually don't use that word because it sounds so hyped up. But the fourth dimension is kind of time, that the structures are not fixed in time, but they can change in time as a result to some stimulus that you apply.
And you can also make materials that don't occur in nature?
Yeah, that's something that I personally enjoy. Actually, we have developed these technologies for the making of these artificial materials. What I like about that is that you can really get weird, highly unusual properties that sometimes I thought would be impossible. And there are now tons of examples from optics, from mechanics, from transport that we and others have realized. And deep down in my heart, that is what drives me in this kind of research.
And not only can you do that, I understand you can mix these metamaterials.
Yeah, in a way, they are a mixture. If you look at what is happening, say, in an inkjet printer, printing many different colors, actually, the printer cannot print different colors. It just puts small spots, small pixels side by side. And then at some point, our human eye cannot resolve these dots, and it looks as if you had a different color. But if you take a microscope, actually, there are spots only of 3 different colors on a piece of paper. And we're basically taking that same idea for metamaterials. If you take a microscope, there will be only few or maybe even only one material. But then if you zoom out, the properties are determined by what you see on the macro scale. You get many different properties, yes.
So you could mix and match and create new ones even if you only had a few different designs in the printer?
Yeah, that's exactly the point. And that's necessary if you want to go towards functional devices. If you take stupid example, a mobile phone that is composed of materials, I don't even know, with hundreds or more different properties. And that's what you need for functioning devices.
And you mentioned in your talk a material that got bigger when you compress it.
Yeah, that's just one of the examples of metamaterials. I chose that example because I find it particularly weird. You would think if you put pressure onto any material, it shrinks. In fact, that's something I've taught to students for semesters and semesters, that anything different from that would be forbidden. But now we can make metamaterials that actually expand, and actually expand a lot in response to an increased air pressure, for example.
So this kind of nano 3D printing, are there commercial devices?
Yeah, I mean, we commercialized this technology with a company called Nanoscribe 12 years ago. That was in 2007. For about 10 years, we were the only ones on the market, and Nanoscribe has been growing considerably. Now, in the last couple of years, there have popped out a couple of companies basically copying Nanoscribe, but I'm part of Nanoscribe, and now it's going to change. But that's a good thing, because for industrial applications, that's a must. Industry is not really accepting incorporating a technology if there's only one supplier on the market. So in a sense, that's also good for Nanoscribe. It's also good for the field, because there are more and more people using this technology. In the scientific arena, there are now 1,000 users worldwide that use Nanoscribe instrumentation.
And were you also looking at self-assembly?
Yeah, I mean, that's something we have not, in my group, not done historically. Of course, many groups have looked at that worldwide. To me, a new kick would be if one could combine the ideas of self-assembly, of directed self-assembly, with a kind of 3D printing. And the reason I'm excited about this is because if you dream about really controlling things down to the atom, and yet you want to make macroscopic structures, you end up with numbers of molecules, say in a cubic centimeter of material, that are Avogadro's constant. So you would have 10 to the 23, 10 to the 24 of atoms, and this would require the same number of bits to even define this kind of structure. And that is completely off scale to what we can say today. So if you want to get that level of control, my dream would be that one can use directed self-assembly on a molecular level to come up to a scale of some tens of nanometers. And then from tens of nanometers up to centimeters, you would use the ideas of 3D printing that we have discussed earlier on.
And could you also use this for nanoelectronics?
You can. We have stayed out of that to a large extent because nanoelectronics is such a well-developed field. I mean, nanoelectronics is in every mobile phone, in every PC, etc. And it doesn't really make sense to compete with this kind of a technology. We have rather focused on things that you could not do previously. But yes, you could also build electronic systems, and perhaps there will be a point when it comes to the retina. It doesn't make any sense to have a retina if you cannot read it out. And this will also require some electronics. You would have to put some electrical contact in three dimension to the retina. Maybe you want to do some electronic pre-processing of this signal. And then, yes, we could make things like that, and that would be very exciting.
What are ubiquitous electronics?
I mean, that's an idea that has been around for, I would think, 20 years or so or more, to not only have electronics in your mobile phone or in a PC, but have it everywhere. I mean, ideas that are around are to include electronics in clothes, to perhaps have sensors in your clothes that sense whatever, I don't know, the body temperature. And as a result, this signal is being sent to somewhere. I don't know, ideas like that. And this is fairly well developed. Such electronic systems can be printed. It's not necessarily 3D printing. It's more planar, two-dimensional kind of printing. And people have gotten very far with this organic electronic. But I think one still has to come up with killer applications that really make it onto the mass market.
And there are nanotechnology degrees now. If people were in high school or early stages of university, what should they be studying to enter your field?
I would still recommend to enter the traditional fields of either physics or chemistry or biology or do some electrical engineering, say as a bachelor. And then if you want to specialize on that ground, it makes sense to go into some nanoscience master program. I don't think it's an idea to start right from the start with knowing a little bit about everything, but not really much about anything. I prefer to focus on something in the early stages of study.
And there may be some of these nano 3D printers coming to Australia, I heard.
There are already a couple in Australia, nanoscrap instrumentation, but I understand that Sydney University is also interested in getting one, and that would be very nice. In fact, during my visits, some contacts have been developed that maybe even before that we start doing some things together.
Well, Professor Martin Wegener, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Professor Martin Wegener from the Karlsruhe Institute of Technology talking about nano 3D printing. And that's all from us this week on Diffusion. Are you a scientist, artist, biohacker or maker who'd like to be interviewed about your work? Would your company like to sponsor Diffusion? Do you have a science outreach grant I should apply for? Send your contributions, opinions, helpful suggestions, and donations to science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com. Please like the Diffusion Science Radio page on Facebook and rate us on iTunes. Tell your friends. Follow me on Twitter @IanWolf. The news music was Rhinos Theme by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. I produce Diffusion, which is broadcast around Australia to 28 stations on the Community Radio Network, including 2RBM in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales, 8CCC in Alice Springs and Tennant Creek, 2MVR in Nambucca Valley, 3MBR in the Mallee Border Districts of Victoria and South Australia, City Park Radio 7LTN in Launceston, Tasmania, 2XXFM in Canberra, and my local station 2RDJ in Burwood, New South Wales. Diffusion is syndicated globally on the National Science Foundation's Science 360 internet radio station and also on astronomy.fm. Subscribe to the podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com. Check the website for links, photos and videos about this week's show. If you enjoyed the show, you can explore more than 950 previous episodes archived on diffusionradio.com, where the shows are labelled by keywords so you can focus in on the stories you want to hear. Join my patrons at patreon.com/diffusionradio. Make a donation through paypal.me/IanWolf. Subscribe to the Diffusion YouTube channel at youtube.com/c/diffusionradio. I'm Ian Wolf. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick. Everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography. Collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.